ברוכים הבאים לדיבור עצמאי, פודקאסט על עיצוב עסקים. אני מיכאל שוורץ, ושבתי היום ג'ונתן סטארק. ג'ונתן, say hello.
Hey, how you doing?
Welcome to my podcast. I'm really excited to have you here today. This is my first international, like, Skype, like, for the podcast thing. And I'm really excited about that. I'm really honored to have you be as the first person to do that. So, welcome.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So, let's dive right in. Just for the people, for the listeners who don't know what that is, like, what is value-based pricing and what do you love about it so much?
When I was, you know, I used to bill by the hour. I was doing software development for a firm and I was managing about 10 other developers and we were just constantly, my whole life was just constantly tracking hours, logging hours, getting the developers to log their hours, creating hours estimates, sending out timesheets, sending out invoices with hours, 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 hours. And it seemed almost 100% of the time that we would go over estimates and clients would argue about hours. So just constantly thinking about hours. And one day it occurred to me that we were basically losing money on our best developer because we paid him the most and he worked really fast. And when he would finish jobs, sometimes before we could even keep him busy. And we had a junior developer who made half as much money. It took forever to do everything. And we billed him out at the same rate. And his clients were perfectly happy. And we were way more profitable from this junior developer than we were from our lead person or one of our best people. And I was like, I just couldn't get my head around that. It didn't make any sense to me. And that's when I stumbled across value pricing. And the idea
just to clear that, the developer that was working really fast was losing money because...
Right, because he would finish things so quickly that we were paying him more than he was bringing in, or about the same, which seems weird because he was efficient. So he did things quickly and correctly the first time, so there was no fooling around. Where someone else would take five times as long to do the same thing, and so they'd get paid more by our client, which means we made more from them. It makes no sense. It's the opposite of what you'd expect.
Yeah, like they're like conflicting interests. It's like your interest is to do it for as many hours as you can, and the client interest is to have it ready as fast as you can, right?
Correct. So I wanted to flip it. I just didn't make sense to me. It took me a long time to even start to question hourly billing as the source of the problem. But as soon as I saw it, I was like, oh, that's the problem. We're billing out people at a particular rate, so whoever takes the longest without making the client upset is going to make the most money, which as a software developer is offensive to think that inefficiency would make more money. You'd want, you know, as I'm a software developer, I want everything to be, you know, I don't want to do busy work. I don't want to do repetitive things. I want things to happen fast, fast, fast. And so if we got better, faster, more efficient at delivering the results that the clients want, we would make less and less money. So I was like that. Once I saw that, I was like an epiphany. I couldn't do it anymore. Immediately, I was like, oh, this is the cause of every problem we have, pretty much.
And then?
So here's the way that value pricing works is that it's essentially fixed bids. So if someone comes to you with a project and they say, hey, we want you to do this project. And you say, okay, let's talk about the project. What are you trying to achieve? So on and so forth. And in an hourly model, you would be talking to that person, trying to figure out roughly how much work you thought it was going to be. You'd be asking scope type things. What do you want us to do? How many tables are going to be in the database? How many pages on the website? How many words do you need me to write? You'd be asking all of these questions about scope and tasks and that sort of thing. And then you'd, you know, make an educated guess about how many hours it was going to take you to do all of those things. And then you'd provide the estimate to the client. And the way that a fixed price would work is that instead of giving them an hourly estimate, you would do all the same things and you'd give them a fixed price. So if you said, well, I think it'll be, you know, roughly $10,000, you know, as an estimate, or you could say, or it'll be like $18,000, but that's a fixed price. And if you do I need to explain what a fixed price project is, or is that
no.
pretty clear? Okay. So the it idea is clear, yeah. in a fixed price model, what most people do when they start out as an hourly biller, most people do what's called a time and materials, take a time and materials approach to quoting the project. So they'll say, well, if I was going to give this person an hourly estimate, I would say $10,000. So I'll give them a fixed price of, you know, that plus some profit. So maybe $12,000, $13,000, something like that. So that's a fixed price project based on time and materials. So it's a cost-based approach. Now, value pricing, right. You also deliver a fixed price quote, but the price is not based on how much work it's going to take you to do it. The price is based on the value of the outcome to the person who's buying it. So in order to calculate your price in a value-based approach, you need to have an understanding of the value of basically of what the project is worth to the client, which forces you to talk about very different things in the sales call. So instead of talking about scope or anything like that, you're talking more about why do you even want to do this project at all? What would a home run look like? Why not do this in some other way? Why do this right now? Why not put it off? When, you know, you ask all these questions about their motivation so that you can find out what a gigantic win would be for them. And what this does is it gives you a sense of what it might be worth to a company like the one you're talking to for this outcome that they're looking for. And it gives you a goalpost. It gives you something to shoot for that, if you hit it, will deliver 100% customer satisfaction. So I liked it a lot better than hourly billing. You know, yes, because you're more profitable, but also it makes it a lot easier to satisfy your clients because it forces you to find out up front what a win looks like, what a success looks like, what a home run looks like. So once you know that, and then you're like, oh yeah, I believe that I can help them reach that. You know, I see what they're trying to do. And all of the details about how many, you know, how many colors or how many revisions or how many words are involved in the project is secondary. It's not used to set the price. So it's a huge, huge mind shift when you're having a sales call and you're planning on giving a value price for the project instead of a time and materials fixed price or an hourly estimate.
One of the big, the things I hear from clients that when you talk about value-based pricing is that they tell you, they're like, when you tell them that the price comes from the value and not from the cost, they'll be like, you want to get 10% of the profits? Are you trying to be my partner?
I don't talk about it with the client.
Like, if you want to take of the profit, you should take of the risk and let's like pay you only after the project is finished, you know?
Yeah, that's an approach, but I would charge a lot of money for that. That's called a contingency fee. And I think it's extremely fair if you can work something out to, it can be fair to both parties if you set the contingency fee correct. So, you know, let's say that's like the ultimate value pricing where you take as the provider, the seller, you take all the risk, virtually all of the risk, yeah. Which means that you should get a massive payoff if it works. So, you know, I don't really advocate that, but you could certainly do it. But the important point here is that when I'm talking to a client, I don't tell them how I'm calculating the prices. We don't get into that. It doesn't matter. I just get to the point where I'm like,
oh, it doesn't matter from the client side?
Sorry?
You don't tell that to the client? Like,
no. How I calculated it? No. If they ask, I'd say, if they said, how did you come up with this price? I would say, based on experience. It seemed, I mean, because of our conversation that we had previously, it seems like a no-brainer compared to, you know, the outcome of what this project would be. So why are you even asking? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's all made up. Even an hourly estimate is just made up. Your hourly rate is a made up. It's just a number you made up. Your estimate of how many hours is going to be just a number you made up. So, you know, maybe there's an educated guess in there, but it's all just made up. So it boils down to, does this outcome seem worth the amount of money that you're going to have to pay me for it. And they can say yes or no, or you can negotiate the terms.
Right. I get it.
So if you go to buy a soda or a coffee, do you ask how they came up with the price?
No, it just kind of makes sense. And if it's either worth it or it's not, you just don't get it. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's, I recognize that a project is more complicated than a cup of coffee, and there's a lot of things that go into that. But if in the initial conversation, you're able to define a desired outcome, a desired business outcome, then there's going to be a value placed on it. Otherwise, they wouldn't be hiring you in the first place. A business doesn't hire another business just for fun or to have like elegant code or make the website pretty. They want some kind of outcome. It could be tangible, could be bottom line, could be top line, could be intangible, could be reputation or morale or customer satisfaction for their customers. But there's a reason. They're not writing checks for no reason. So, and they're going to measure something. And I can prove that because if you get to the end of a project, sometimes clients are happy and sometimes they aren't. Well, why? Because they're measuring something. It's not just a gut instinct. You know, they're looking at something that causes them to react with satisfaction or dissatisfaction. So if you find out in advance what they're going to look at the end, it makes everybody's job so much easier because you can measure it along the way. And at the end, there's no like big surprise. You can, you know, it's like if you know where you're driving, then you can get there more easily. If you don't know where you're driving and they just give you a bunch of tasks to do, it's like driving around with your eyes closed, just like using best practices and, you know, like, oh, well, you know, these colors work in these kinds of situations and I like this, typeface, or I should use this platform because I'm familiar with it. You make all of these decisions that may or may not, probably won't lead to a goal if you don't know what the goal is. So my favorite thing about value pricing is that it forces the seller to find out what a success is. Like, what does the client want after all of this work? You know, what are they trying to do? And there's your value. The value is what it's worth to the client. And so if you just set a price that's like a tenth of that, you know, just to pull a number out of the air, a tenth of that, and they trust you, you're credible, they believe that you can do what you say you can do, why wouldn't they pay it? How you came up with the number is not relevant.
Yes, but there's like, let's try start building the case about the situation in Israel. I think there's since, like in the past, I guess 10 years or something like that, design of digital products has grown and developed a lot of mythologies that are very much about like the customer and the client and the user, you know, and thinking about user experience and thinking about business side of things. So in a way, thinking about the outcomes became in a way like a commodity, something that if your prices are too high, I'm going to hire some other agency or someone else to do that because it's part of the workflow. There's nothing special about that. You know what I mean?
Yes. Well, the important word to use there is commodity. So yes, if a client is comparing you apples to apples with other sellers and the other sellers are less expensive and the client who has an untrained eye, they don't do what you do. The client with an untrained eye cannot tell the difference in a meaningful way between you and the next person. Then yeah, they're going to pick the cheapest one because it's the only difference that they see. So it's incumbent on people who are running their own business, which is, you know, every freelancer out there and solo consultants and small firms, you're all running a business. And if your clients can't tell the difference between you and somebody else, then of course, you know, like that's bad. So you need to appear different. You want to create an apples to oranges comparison, or better yet, apples to like pineapple or something a little bit more exotic. Because the more ultimately you want to be a category of one where there really is no option. Like you're the only one that does what you do. So like, for example, think of any big brand, like if I go to Starbucks, I'm not getting a coffee, I'm getting a Starbucks. You can't get a Starbucks at a Dunkin' Donuts. So like, that's why they can justify a price premium, because they're different. It's not the same thing. There's more to it than just the coffee. So for the designers, let's say, there needs to be something different about you that is detectable and meaningful to the kind of clients that you want to work with. And you see this all the time. It's not super, well, I should say I see it all the time because I'm looking for it. But there are certainly companies out there that get this, and they either stand for something or they package their services in a way that are very easy to understand to the untrained, you know, this sort of outsider, untrained observer. But if you just talk about, you know, you just have like a portfolio up there of pretty pictures and you're never connecting the dots between what you do and what benefits it provides to your clients, then the whole thing turns into a beauty contest and they're just going to pick the cheapest one that looks good enough.
But it feels like the case of measuring business outcomes, mm-hmm. It's like that became something that everyone does. Every company does that. Because the user experience methodologies like include that. It's like, you know, like you're designing products with ways of designing products of taking the users into account and thinking about the business goals of that product, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's like, it's became, you know, just thinking about the end goal of your client has become something that is part of the process as product designers who work
when they're
on
doing
digital
their, when they're
products.
Doing their work.
Yeah.
Right. But it doesn't sound to me like they're doing it in the sales process for their client. So there's a difference between the measurable outcome of, let's say you're going to build I'm from the software space. So let me use an example from my world that I think makes sense. Let's say, well, here's a designy, web designy type of thing. Let's say somebody is hiring you to build them a SaaS, like they have an idea for a business and you're going to design the user experience for a SaaS product. And their long-term goals are to do $1 million a month in revenue, let's just say. In the project, you'll be able to make decisions about things that might lead to that as an outcome. Mm-hmm. But you are so far in advance of any of that. You're way, way, way before them dealing with things like converting free trials and churn and those sorts of things. And yes, you might do some things that will decrease churn, let's say, but the company as a business could screw up a million things. You could do everything right and the company could screw up a million things and they would never get that benefit. They would never, you know what I mean? It's out of your control to a large degree. The thing that you're pricing is not that outcome way down in the future. It's pricing why hire someone like me. It's what is the value of hiring someone like me to help you at this stage? So it's not that you're measuring the thing that maybe will happen someday if, you know, everything goes right. It's that you're measuring the outcome of the engagement at the end of the engagement. So at the end of the engagement, are they going to be happy or sad? And they're going to be one or the other. They're going to be one or the other. So you need to find out, or you want to find out in advance, what is going to make them happy instead of sad. And it's going to happen immediately. It's not going to be off in some distant future. So, for example, you could say, well, you know, the client calls you and said, hey, we understand you do user experience. We've got this. We heard you're good. We've got this project we want to do. And, we'd like to have you design the user experience. Like, all right, let's have a conversation. And see if there's a good fit here. And so you have this meeting. It's sort of like a get to know you meeting. You could think of it as a sales meeting, but really it's more like an interview than a sales meeting. And you're interviewing each other. And when I walk into a meeting like this, I try to talk the client out of hiring me. I look for every excuse why they wouldn't want to hire me. And I'll start by, because I don't want to take their money if I can't deliver a big return. So I'll say, if they said something like, well, we want you to do this list of things, and be like, all right, tell me about all the things. Tell me about the project. Tell me what you think you want. And once they've got all of that off of their chest, I'll say, that's awesome. Thank you. I've got 3 pages of notes here. That's very helpful. Can we back up for a second so I understand the context of the whole project so I can make decisions along the way about what the goals might be and so on and so forth. So the first question is, why even do this at all? Why not just leave things the way they are? And the client doesn't usually think like that in a meeting like this because they're way beyond that. They've already had that feeling a long time ago, and they've made a bunch of decisions that they wouldn't think to share with you at this stage unless you ask. So I ask, like, why not do this? You know, hiring someone like me is going to be very expensive. I'll tell you right now. It's going to be risky to do a big software project. It's always risky. Half of them fail, literally. So, mm-hmm. You know, why not just not do this? And they'll say, like, oh, well, that's a good question. X, Y, and Z. And they'll give you some reason. Or they'll say, you're right, we shouldn't do it. But 99% of the time, they're going to say, well, for these reasons, we need to do it. We need to do this. Otherwise, our competitor who just came to market with a really sexy new product is going to, we believe that they're going to take all of our customers. All right, that's a good reason. Do you need to do it right now, or do you want to wait a few months, 6 months, study the problem, see if they go away, see if it fails, blows up in their face, and then you've saved all the money that you would have paid me? No, we need to do it right now because we feel like we're already behind the eight ball. Our salespeople are telling us that clients are testing the other product. We have reason to believe that this is urgent. Okay, now what's happening is they are convincing me that they do need to hire me. They are going to benefit from working with me. So then I'll go down to the last of these why questions, I call them, and be like, well, why would you hire someone expensive like me? You guys are talented. You could just do this in-house. Why not just do it in-house? Well, our people are busy. We don't really want to focus on this aspect of it. We want to focus somewhere else, maintaining the existing software while we do this V2 or whatever it is. I'll say, okay, well, why not outsource it to a lower wage region where you can get, you know, 10 times as many people as just me for the same price? We tried that before and the time zones were a problem, or the language barrier was a problem, or all of these problems. I say, okay, I'm convinced. I think there's a good fit here. I'll put together a proposal and get back to you. If it's okay, I'll give you three different options for ways to work with me, ways we could possibly work together. And you can just choose the one that suits your budget, your timing, all of the things that you want. They say, okay. And I go back and what I've done by asking them all those questions is I've surfaced every possible objection to my price. I've said repeatedly that I am not going to be the cheapest option.
Even before you started talking about like what's that price going to be? I mean, from what you're saying, you first handle the objection and then you give the price. Like you don't give the price to hear the objections and then address them.
Correct. That's a giant waste of time. Yes.
All right. I think it's a big takeaway from
the proposal should basically just like there should be no surprises in the proposal, really. All of the important words in the proposal, almost all of them will be stuff the client said to you in the interview. It's mostly words right out of their mouth that I'll put straight onto the page. So when I'm talking to them, I'm taking notes like crazy because I'm going to use those words, literally the same words in the proposal. So when they get it and they read it, they're like, yeah, he's right. Yeah, he's right. Yeah, he's right. We tried to outsource this before and it blew up in our face. We do have to do this right now because our competitor is stealing our clients. We can't not do this. You know, this is the way to do it because of our strategic objective from our investors or whatever the thing is. So I make them convince me that it's worth my time to spend a couple hours putting a proposal together.
Let me ask you this. Do you still work with clients?
I stopped taking on clients last year.
Mm-hmm. So
yeah,
I mean,
but I did it for 10 years. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, all those questions you're asking, they're like filtering away a lot of clients, right? So you need to have a constant flow of people coming to you, so you can just filter most of them away, right?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say constant flow, but that's the idea. You need to be prepared to say no to people. You need to be, So you have to do things to make yourself stand out in the marketplace, to create awareness of your services, the type of value that you bring to clients. Yeah, I mean, you can't just sit there hoping like people are going to see your online portfolio and call you. You can do outreach too, but you know, doing things like writing books, having a podcast, having a mailing list, speaking at conferences, going to trade association meetups and these kinds of things. Yeah, you have to do marketing. I mean, you're running a business. mean, if you only get one lead, if you only get one or two leads a year, you're not going to be able, you're not going to have the confidence to have this kind of a conversation. You're going to be desperate and they're going to know you're desperate. And if you're desperate, you have no way to negotiate. You have no power in the negotiation. So of course you're going to get beat up on price. You need to be willing to walk away from every single negotiation. If you're not, you need to get your finances squared away or your marketing squared away or something so that you're not desperate to land every single lead that comes through the door.
So if like someone hasn't built his name yet, right? Do you suggest first building your brand or first starting with value-based pricing?
I don't see those as necessarily in competition with each other or in conflict with one another. Are we talking about someone who, are you talking about someone who knows what they're doing or they don't even really know what they're doing yet?
I think we're talking about someone who knows what they're doing first, like professionals.
So, they're good at, well, give me an example.
They build websites.
They build websites. Okay. And they're good at it. Like they know what they're doing. They're not a beginner. Okay.
They know what they're doing. So they're good with branding. They're good with the technology. Yes.
Okay. So let's say they work in-house. Let's say they've been working in-house building WordPress sites for some big company, you know, doing like event sites for some sort of, for TED. They work for TED conferences and they build different event sites to market the TED conferences. They get really good at it. They feel a sense of mastery. They feel like they know what they're doing. They're very confident in their skills. And for whatever reason, they get disillusioned at the at their employer and they decide to go out on their own, whether they think, you know, whether they're trying to escape from a bad boss or they think there's going to be more freedom or whatever it is. So they decide to go, or they can make more money. So they go solo and you could start value pricing immediately, but I think your question is more about how do you get clients coming to you so that you can start to do that. So what I would say is, yeah, how do you get that? How do you get a pipeline? How do you start to get leads when you're new, even though you know what you're doing? So the first thing I would do is I would, the very first thing I would do is reach out to my network of people that I know. And I would do this thing called the introduction game. It's like an exercise where you'd say, you say, hey, everybody I know, it could be your mom, it could be your brother, it could be your brother-in-law, people who trust you. They don't need to be in your line of business, just people that you trust and that trust you. You say, hey, does anybody know a particular kind of person? And you need to figure out what that is for you, but it could be something like, does anybody know the somebody on the board of directors of a nonprofit organization? Or does anybody know someone who runs some sort of mission-driven business around, I don't know, environmental causes? Does anybody know someone who has runs a dental practice with more than four seats or a salon? Does anybody know anybody who owns thoroughbred horses? It doesn't matter. You need to think about who is it that you want to talk to. Who are you likely to be able to serve really well? If you just came from working at TED, I'd probably say, hey, does anybody know anybody who's putting together their own events, like live speaking events, like event organizers? I'd like to talk to them about, you know, something I'm thinking about. You know, I'm thinking about going solo. Could I talk to people who are in that space? And the way that social networking works, the number of people that are like, if you know 1,000 people, if you're connected to 1,000 people, then you're actually connected to 1,000,000 people one step out from there. So it's almost certain that someone in your circle of trusted contacts is going to know someone directly or one person away from someone who might make a really good client for you. That's the first thing I would do. So get in contact with a bunch of people through a trusted third party to, you know, talk to them about like to see if there's a fit for your services in their organization or on a freelance basis or consulting basis. Your other question about getting leads, I would along the way. So that would be my first step. I would try and get as many phone calls set up like that as I possibly could. You know, have as many conversations as you can with people. And when you're on those conversations, you want to be looking for expensive problems or big opportunities that they recognize in their business. Just be interested in them, talk to them about what's going on, and maybe not even like, I don't know what the odds are, but there's some non-zero odd or percentage chance that there's going to be some good fit there that you could potentially, you know, write a proposal. You know, so they say, oh yeah, you know what, this is great timing. I can't believe, you know, Bob introduced us. We're actually looking for something like this. And then this normal sales interview, like I talked about already. Once you kind of like sort of bootstrap your flow of leads and you've got some work lined up, even if you do bill by the hour at first, the thing you need to do is make sure that you don't overdo it with client work. You're going to be like excited and like, wow, I landed this project and geez, I can't believe it. I got like 3 clients right out of the gate, but now I'm working 60, 70 hours a week trying to do all this client work. And this is where the feast famine cycle comes from. You have absolutely no time to work on your business. So when those 3 projects are over, you're back to zero. You got to start all over again. And you don't want to, and now you can't email your whole network again because eventually they're going to wear out. They're not going to be, you know, there's no story there. There's no more like, oh, you know, Jeff just went solo. Isn't that cool? Could you talk to him about some possibilities? All of a sudden you're just another freelancer scrounging for work. So what you want to do while you do have those clients is to make sure that you spread out the work enough that you can spend 10 or 20 hours a week working on your business so that you can take this tiny flame that you've created and build it into a larger sort of roaring campfire.
What do you mean spread out the work enough?
What was that question?
What do you mean spread out the work enough? Like for a longer period of time? Right.
Yes. The same number of hours over a longer number of calendar weeks. So if you have like, for example, let's just say you have 1 client and you charge them $100 an hour for what you do. Mm-hmm. They are going to want you to squeeze as many hours as you can into each week because the sooner you're done, the quicker they get returns on their investment. Mm-hmm. So if you're building a website for somebody, they want it immediately. They want it like yesterday. So there's going to be a lot of pressure from them for you to work 40, 50, 60 hours a week to get it done quickly because it doesn't cost them anymore. Same number of hours.
Yeah.
But at the
end. Exactly. I know designers who, like, that's their value proposition. I do it really fast.
And they charge hourly?
They charge higher. They charge, like, higher rates than, like, I don't know, regular hourly. Like, more than the industry standards, I guess. Mm-hmm. And that's what they offer. Like, I will do it really, really fast.
Yeah. So what they're saying is, I'm cheaper. They're trying to justify a higher hourly rate by saying that they'll be cheaper in the long run because they'll do the work. You know, my hourly rate's twice as high, but I'm going to do it 3 times as fast. So you end up saving money. I'm cheaper. So I don't love that. What I'm saying is if you have, even if that's true, let's say the client is like, yes, okay, fine. $200 an hour. You're going to do it faster. The client still is going to want you to jam all of those hours as close to now as possible so that they'll be done sooner, so that the website will be up sooner. They're anxious. They've got people that are waiting for it. They've got a sales team that's chomping at the bit to get out there and sell stuff, and they can't do it until you're done with the website. So they're going to try and consume your entire calendar until it's done. And if you get into the habit of doing that, you end up never having time to attract new leads. So regardless of how much money you're making from it, if you're busy 60 hours a week, you're not going to have the energy left over to then go speak at a conference or then go write a book or then put together some sort of email course, you know, to attract new clients. Mm-hmm. It's just not sustainable. So we're talking a little bit about 2 different things, but the thing I'm trying to get at is when you first go solo from in-house, you've got a built-in marketing story because you told the boss to take this job and shove it, and people want to help you, and it seems like people get a lot of leads right out of the gate because of that story. People want to share that message. They want to help the underdog. But you want to, what I was saying before was like, you just don't want to squeeze in, get excited and work 60 hours a week for the client, because then you just, you're just still
because the minute the excitement is over, you just become that broke freelancer again.
Yeah.
Part of the statistic.
So, right. And so the other thing that you want to do while you've got this first, second, third, maybe third job, third client, you want to be measuring results, because at the end of that, at the end of the each engagement, you want to be able to put some kind of numbers up on your website in a testimonial of some kind or a case study. You want, at the end, you don't want to get, you know, your client Alice, who you build a WordPress site for her event production business. You don't want her at the end to say, Mike was such a nice guy. He was a pleasure to work with. You don't want that. I mean, it's fine, but what would be better is if she said something like, Mike transformed our business. I was able to double our capacity. I was able to do twice as many events this year because of the automation he included on the website. Our website became a lead generation machine. We've got 20,000 leads this month instead of last month when we had 10,000. You want numbers because, you know, and they can be measuring numbers, intangible things like outcomes, net promoter score or something like that. But you want to be watching some kind of KPIs or whatever metrics that they care about, the thing, the needle that you're trying to move. You want to be tracking that along the way. So at the end, when you release this new logo or this rebrand of a website, Alice is going to be happy or not happy based on factors. Find out those factors in advance, even if you're billing by the hour. Track those factors throughout the project. And at the end of the project, make sure that those factors are where they need to be for Alice to be happy. And then you can say, Alice, I am so glad that you are over the moon about the way this project went. I am super happy about it too. Thank you for the kind words you shared in the kickoff meeting. It's fine to say no, but would it be all right for me to share your words on my website? And she'd probably going to say yes. Sometimes they don't, but probably they'll say yes. And you say, great. You know, can I just, you know, I'll just write down what you said and send it to make sure I heard it right and make sure you have approval on it. And the thing that you want in there is a number, some kind of number. It can be relative. It can be absolute, you know, like relative, like doubled our business or doubled our leads or doubled our conversion rate. Or it can be, you know, a specific dollar amount. You know, it took us from $1 million in revenue to whatever. So, I'm using numbers that are pretty bottom line, but they can be intangible things like morale or customer satisfaction. Or, I mean, we rate intangible things all the time. Like every 5-star rating you see on Amazon is measuring an intangible called customer satisfaction. But we're used to it. It seems real. I mean, everything I buy on Amazon, if it doesn't have 4 stars or higher, I'm probably not going to buy it, even though it's totally subjective and not scientific in any way. So you want your clients, your first early clients, you want to have results, measurable results at the ends of these projects that you can put on your website, and that will differentiate you from the vast majority of your competitors, because you deliver results. You don't deliver pretty logos. You deliver results.
Mm-hmm. All right. So I have another some questions from listeners. Like I told you that user experience projects tend to be long, and you tend to not know at the beginning how it's going to end. What's going to be, like, you don't even know what's the product. There's like a phase of discovery and research, and then you start working on it, and that thing changes all the time during the entire process. There are changes, like when you talk to Chris Doe, you said that you don't believe in change orders, right?
Correct. Yeah, I've never sent one.
But in the process of user experience products, it's like part of the process.
Only if you're of course, only if you're pricing the work. I don't price the work. I price the outcome. So, you know, in software, there's a concept of agile methodology, agile project management, where you're constantly iterating. And if I tried to, if anyone tried to know in advance all of the steps that we were going to take from, you know, kickoff day to launch day, or sorry, from kickoff of the project to the launch of the project, it's ridiculous. Of course you don't know. You have no idea. Yeah. It's not like you're, you know, building and the one or the 10,000th McDonald's, it's different every time. So that's not what you price. You price the outcome. So if the outcome of the project, if everybody agrees on the outcome of the project, whatever it is, then changes along the way are good for everyone because it means you get to the outcome faster. And if you get to the outcome faster, then going down a rabbit hole and doing the wrong thing and like releasing it and the results don't happen and then you have to go back and do it more. It's not about knowing everything in advance like waterfall and pricing that. That's scope thinking. That's pricing the work. That's cost thinking. Mm-hmm. You need to price the outcome, and then changes which are natural, as you pointed out, and as I've seen in like virtually every software project I've ever done, there's always changes, yeah. But I just don't charge for them because we're all on the same team. We're all driving to the same place. Maybe I've got to take a detour, but it's better than sitting in traffic. As long as we get to our, you know, get to our, the faster we get to the final destination, the better it is for me and the better it is for the client. But I can, you know, I know where your head's at because you're like, yeah, but they're going to work me to death. They're going to keep changing stuff forever.
It's not about working to death. It's about how much you estimate, like the way that you estimate the outcome, right? That might mm-hmm. not be worth your time.
Yes, correct. Yes. So don't take that project.
But how can you know in advance?
You can tell because it has to be a huge difference. So like, for example, we're talking a lot about implementation type projects, it sounds like, versus, so let's stick with implementation. So like designing and building a website, or let's just say building a website. Okay. You build out a website. Right. It's a big website, a lot of departments in the company. It's going to be a lot of meetings and you build it out. It's going to take 6 months for sure. Okay. So that's a lot of work for you. So the price for it to make sense for you to do that work, you know, let's just think about it cost wise. Let's just say you'd have to make $50,000 for 6 months to even be thinking about doing it, just to pick a number. If you're talking to them in advance and you're like, well, okay, it's great that you want to work with me. I love the idea of working on websites. It's my favorite thing. I'd love to work with you guys. It's going to be a lot of money to do this, and it's going to take a lot of time from your employees. I'm going to have to be interviewing your employees quite a bit. It's a big investment. So I don't see the business case for why you're doing this. Why are you doing this? What needle are you trying to move? How's your business going to be better if we do this? Because I don't want to take your money if you're not going to be like building a statue of me after we're done. Like, I want this to be a giant success, and I just don't see why you would do this. And if they can come up with some reason that they just haven't shared with you because they wouldn't think to, of like, well, no, this is going to be huge because we've got a terrible employee churn problem in the call centers. And if we can improve this user interface, we're hoping that that's going to cut, you know, all of this cost off of our top line and we won't have to be replacing employees constantly. Oh, that's a good reason. So if the value there, even ballpark value, is like, you know, $50,000 per person who they don't have to retrain or replace, and how many people are in the call center? 200. Okay, well, do you think it's possible for a project like this to, you know, change that by 10%? Oh yeah, that's what we think. Yes, 10% would be a home run. If we could change it by 5%, that would be amazing. So now you're thinking, okay, this is a design project that has real value in it because we're going to change this user experience for all these people who are just, the morale is in the toilet. So they're going to be a lot happier. They're not going to be quitting all the time, so on and so forth. So, but what you're getting to is that the client might not be able to answer your question. They might be like, I don't know. My boss told me to find someone to build this website. In which case, you're talking to the wrong person and you need to get past that person. That person's a gatekeeper and they cannot answer the questions that you need to ask. So you have to get to whoever did make the decision, find out what their goal is, because at the end of the project, when it launches, that's the person that will swoop in and say, this is terrible. We need to do all of these things over again. And like, I'm sure that's happened to everyone at least once. So to short answer to that last question is, you just price it high enough so change orders don't matter.
That seems really high sometimes.
Well, a value's got to be there. If there's no value, you shouldn't take the job. See what I mean? The value pricing protects the client because they can never pay more than it's worth to them. It's impossible. Mm-hmm. So getting them to their goal as quickly as possible is great for you. They're not going to be doing change orders for no reason. They want to be done too. So if everybody's really clear about the desired outcome, let's say the desired outcome is to decrease churn in the call center by 10% by December, you can measure that along the way. And then when a client comes running in with some change order, like, we need to make the logo bigger, we need to make the black a little blacker, you can say, all right,
how's that going to affect It's not about, sorry, Jonathan, it's not about change orders. It's not the right word for it, because I think maybe iterations is more appropriate, because you, like, you try stuff, you do it, you work on it, you improve it, and you get, like, you understand new things along the way, right? So it's not about change orders. It's about how you like focus your product and make it more like accurate for the thing that you're trying to do, the problem you're trying to solve, and
that's what I'm talking about.
There's something about that process that you don't know how it's going to change.
But you do,
and how much time it's going to take.
But you do know what the client wants. You do know what your client wants.
Yeah.
If you do know what your client wants, you don't know how you're going to get there. It's like, fine. I mean, you can see the mountaintop. You've got a compass. We'll get there. But you need to really want to get to the mountaintop, because it's going to be a lot of work. There are going to be a lot of surprises, and I'm going to charge you through the nose to do it. So if you really want to go over there, let's do it. It has everything to do with pricing it right. So you need to find jobs where the outcome is very valuable, and the client sees that, and there's, you know, then you can price it in a way that changes like that don't matter. Now, this is really hard to get your head around if you're used to doing implementation projects where the goal is not defined. That's what most people do. Most people get called by a client and they say, hey, you do UX. Can you do some UX for us? You say yes. They say, great. What's your rate? You say $100 an hour. They say, great. You can get started on Monday. Here's a list of features we want you to start working on or start thinking about. Nobody ever has a conversation. It's very rare to have a conversation with the client at the early stages about, wait a second, what are you trying to achieve? I might not be able to do it. Like, the thing that you want to get out of this that you haven't even told me because I didn't ask, I might not be the right person to get you there. I might be the wrong driver. So let's figure that out. Yes. And if there's a fit, then great. If not, you just don't take it.
I think there's something about, yes, but there's, it's like kind of the, I don't know if they said that in English, the egg and the chicken, what came first?
Yeah.
Like, You're talking about projects that are really high value, but the way there, but you, like, if you're like starting now, or you don't have your brand really recognized, and you don't have enough brand awareness to, like, to what kind of good professional you are, you are not an option for those type of projects to begin with. You know what I mean?
Yes and no, because,
like, you're going for really big projects, but
so, you know, how do you get there? How do you get big clients with big budgets to come in and write you big checks?
How do you get to a place where change orders and changes of iterations and more work is not even a thing?
You start small. So do smaller projects with smaller clients. But it's the same exact situation. So, for example, I interviewed a guy named Ben Manley on my podcast recently, and he runs a dev shop. They build Squarespace. They basically build sites for clients, and they build it in one day. They build an entire site in one day, and I don't know what the prices are right now, but it's less than 10,000. So, if you want a gorgeous website in one day, you write this guy a check, you go through his process, and at the end of the day, you have your website. So it's the exact same thing. He's not taking on giant corporate clients. He's got a he's got an outcome. This is a productized service. It's not value priced, but it's not based on trading time for money. So you can start small in that way by saying, all right, here's a particular kind of service that's very repeatable. It's easy for me to do. I can get really good at client management. And it's just clearly defined. It's packaged up like a product. It's treated in the buyer's brain like a product, like a lamp or a couch. And you think, oh, well, here's this thing. Here's what's included. Here's how much it costs. It's all on the web page. This seems like a good deal. I'm going to do it. You go through the process. At the end, you're happy. and Ben or whoever has basically created a small repeatable project that literally takes one day with some, that's not, maybe not 100% true. There's some prep work. You have to talk a couple times ahead of time. So maybe it's 2 days of actual work. It's maybe 10 hours of actual work. And it's super, but it's small. It's very manageable. It's not risky. So that would be, you know, if I was starting out, that's what I would do. I'd find like a repeatable small type of project that I could price independent of how many hours it took me to execute. And once you start delivering results, deliver results, and then bigger fish come around and they say, we'd like some of those results. And you say, great, let's talk, see if there's a good fit.
Right.
It's all about, yeah, it's all about delivering customer satisfaction reliably, which means finding out how to satisfy them before you start.
That's a great takeaway from that situation. All right, there's another issue. Like one last thing, right? We should be finishing soon, right? Okay. Let's like take the situation to the real world, right? You got a bunch, like a couple of people showing up at your door, and they want to create some kind of product, an app or a website or whatever. And they want you to help them with that. And it's like really far. It's like they think that it's going to be really profitable. It's going to be a big deal someday, one day, right? And you can't you can't guarantee that. You can't know whether it's that going to happen or not. So there's something about their vision that you're trying to understand the money price, the price of that, the value of that vision, and like take your fee from that.
It's not the value of their vision. It's the value of your part, your contribution. So
yes, but the end goal doesn't go in, like you might do that correct and nothing's going to happen with it. And you might, it's like something about the design work and the UX work is, if it's a new product, you don't know what the ROI going to be.
It's not, you're thinking of only one kind of ROI. You're thinking of like the downstream ROI. It's immediate. The ROI I'm talking about is immediate. It's when you're done. As soon as you're done, the ROI is realized. It's what it's worth to the client for you to do the thing you did, to achieve the outcome that you achieved. So to put it another way, let's say you do just like upfront design planning. So you don't actually do any implementation. You just do things like, set a color palette and do like wireframes or prototypes. You do the front end stuff, and then a bunch of other people are going to implement it, right?
Right.
So you're not even building the thing. Literally doing the what I would consider the pure design part, where you're just designing it. You're not executing the design. What's it worth? Why not do it? Why not have somebody plan out the design and pick the colors and the type and how the flow is going to go? Why not just start coding? And an immature, inexperienced business owner will do that. They're like, yeah, you know what? We're not going to pay you $100,000 to design the thing first. We're just going to start coding. Okay. That's how they learn their lesson. That ends up usually as a mistake. And later, when they're older, they're like, nah, next time we're paying for designer. So, it doesn't work on everybody. Like, not everybody can articulate the desired outcome, or you can't get past the gatekeeper to somebody who has the actual answer, or the outcome that they have is not really that valuable, and the amount of work that it would take you to achieve it would be too great. It doesn't mean like all of a sudden you can start printing money. It means that you'll end up working with fewer customers more profitably, and you need to start attracting the right kinds of people who are going to value that sort of thing. Any business, if you're in design, not sales, you can't affect sales directly. You're very much going to be upstream from sales, which is where the money is actually made. You're very far upstream from that. So you need to come up with some kind of leading indicator that the client believes will improve something about their business. And you can achieve it immediately. Like once it's done, it's done. Even if it's a wireframe. Why not do the wireframe? Yeah. Well, because then the software will probably stink. We'll be iterating in code instead of iterating on a piece of paper, which is much more expensive. Oh, how much more expensive? Well, we've got three programmers working on it at $100 an hour. Everybody thinks it'll take at least 6 months. No way it's going to take less than 6 months. So, do the math. All right. I mean, do you think that, skipping the design phase would increase the duration of the build by, I don't know, a month? Probably if we don't design it, it'll probably take a year and it might stink. So, okay. So then the design has a value.
And that
if someone is going to write you a check, they think they're going to get value in return. They're trading you this money for something they think they're getting. But a lot of people never find out what the thing is. Like they never talk about what is the thing that I see you're giving me money, but what am I giving you? And a lot of times the buyer and the seller in cases like this have two different things in their head. The seller, especially a designer, thinks they want a beautiful design. They don't want a beautiful design. They want an effective design. Maybe it'll have to be beautiful. Maybe it needs to be ugly because they want the product to look cheap because they're trying to, this is a bargain basement store. We want the flyer to look cheap because our prices actually are cheap. That's the brand. So,
I think that's a problem there because design is so upstream. It's before development and it's before sales and it's before other stuff. It's something like in the idea phase. It's not in the idea phase. It's something really in the beginning. It's like designers should really think about how to set ROIs for their work.
Well,
because there's
it. You uncover it. You don't set. You can't set it. It's different for every buyer. Some people value design. Some people don't. You can be just as good of a designer, but some people just don't care. So you need to find people who really care. So you can just look around and see what companies are spending tons of money on design. So like Nike, Apple, Starbucks, this Target, they spend tons of money on design. They obviously care about it.
Yeah.
They value it. So you want to go after clients who clearly value design, and then they'll know, because they're used to it, they'll know when you say, why not do this? Why not skip over this step? They'll say, well, that would be insane because, and then you're listening when they say, because, why would it be insane to skip over the design phase? Well, because it'll blow up on our face 5 ways from Sunday. Oh yeah, like what? Like what way? They'll tell you, or they'll say, yeah, you know what? Someone told us we should hire a designer. We don't really know what we want it to look like. We don't really know what we're trying to do. We're just a couple of coders. We have an idea, then there's just not like a client like that's a bad fit for really any professional, honestly, not just designers. If they don't know what they want, there's no way to satisfy them. And if you're not satisfying your clients, you're not going to be in business for very long.
That's right. All right. So let me try and conclude our conversation with a couple of bullet points. So the first thing is you have to have to build your personal brand, right? To become an expert in your field and hopefully in a field that you are alone there.
Yeah, a category of one. You want to be unique.
A category of one.
You need to stand out from the crowd in some way that's meaningful to your clients. Not meaningful to you, meaningful to your clients.
So, and the next point is that you need to have a flow of a pipeline, a flow of clients who will come to you asking for to work with you. And out of those clients, you will have to ask them, try to talk them out of it. And only mm-hmm. those who stay and only those who stay will be the ones who will who would agree to pay higher more money than they would expect to pay some yeah. commoditized agency.
Right. Yep. Because they're a good fit. Like you found someone that's a good fit. And the more yeah. people that you talk to, the more likely it is to find someone like that.
Yeah. And once you find them, you have to understand what is the thing that you are working on in terms of customers, of the client success. Like what's going to make them happy? What's the thing that's going to make them happy at the end of the project, and not what's the thing that's going to make the most money at the like when the thing's going to launch 6 months after you have delivered all of your the assets that you created.
Right.
Yeah, it's the thing that was hardest for me to wrap my head around because I cannot. I find it really a lot harder to tie my like my work with outcomes that are not like business. Like the classic business term of how much money they're gonna make from launching that
right
product, or right. how much money they're gonna save from improving that user experience problem. So
yes, yeah, you need to find something that for designers especially, you need to find something that is going to make them happy immediately. Something that you can measure immediate. That they believe will contribute to this farther down the road goal. But it needs to come from their mouth. This is the reason we're even talking to people like you, because we know we need to move this needle right here. That's probably the weirdest part of all of it. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't know if I should ask you about like what is a good example of... Okay, so we said that not to connect your work with outcomes downstream, like you said, right? To have the customer happy once you finish the project. You are part of the project, right? So you I'm trying to think
what's an example?
What are the things, what examples? I don't know if it's a good question for you because you're not a designer.
Well, a style guide. Like you can let's say a style guide.
Yeah.
The client will tell you what it's worth to them when you're talking to them. Like that's like, why not have a style guide to your client?
Because.
And every client's going to give you a different reason. Some are going to be like, yeah, you know, I don't even think it's important, but the CFO said we should do it. Or other people would be like, oh, are you crazy? If we didn't have a style guide, did you hear what happened to Walmart? Their brand was just a mess, or Best Buy, and we don't want that to happen. That's not happening on my watch. Like, all right, well, how will you know, like, how are you going to measure the success of the style guide? Like, is it going to be something, like, are you going to know it when you see it? What? And you have to uncover it from the client. Some are going to value it, some are not going to value it. You can't make them stick to the style guide after you give it to them. That's a separate thing. In fact, I might even put that in as an option on the proposal. Option one is, you called me in here to reach this goal. I think the solution is to have a style guide. It's going to be $50,000. Option two is I'll provide 3 months of onboarding and oversight for your internal employees to make sure that they're implementing the style guide properly. I'll sort of watchdog it as things are going through production. And then option three might be $150,000, where you also sort of watchdog any third parties that are using the brand in public, and you're in charge of making sure they get taken down or replaced or given the proper thing, and you just be the liaison for that whole thing. So now I've taken potentially relatively simple job where you're creating let's just say it's like a 10-page PDF of logo treatments in various situations. How long is that going to take you to make?
And buttons and input fields and all the UI components and all the elements.
Yeah.
I can see the case there. Like, it makes sense because you have consistency, you have the developers not, like, they have more efficient work, they can deliver product, the like, parts of the product faster.
Exactly.
That makes sense. Mm-hmm. You can make sense of how is that a good foundation for a product.
Mm-hmm.
Having a solid design system or a style guide.
If you believe that design has value, you have to ask yourself, well, what's the value? It's not my work. It's not that I put the time in, therefore they should pay me. That's not the value. The value is what good design does. So find people who value that, and people who recognize the value and place value on it, and people who don't value it, either sell them very small, tiny things that are, you know, products maybe that you don't even have to implement, just like something they can buy from your website and use it as like a starter template or things like that. But your bigger sort of, I call helicopter options, like the really big expensive options, just attract those kind of clients that already value design. If you find yourself in a conversation with a client, a prospect, trying to convince them that what you do is valuable, it's not a good client.
No.
Like,
no, you should
get someone else. You're not going to change their mind.
Exactly. Okay. Thank you very much. It was a very interesting conversation, and I had a lot of fun talking to you.
Yes.
I think is it okay if I add you to the Facebook group?
I'm not on Facebook anymore, but...
Hey, where can we reach you?
Best place to go would be... I have an email course called Value Pricing Bootcamp. You can go to valuepricingbootcamp.com, mm-hmm. and I go into detail with like 5 or 6 emails across the course of a week that drill into some of the specifics of this, that people can try that out for free. A lot of people really like it, and that's the place I would go. And I read all the replies, so if you have any questions on any of those emails, just hit reply and I'll get back to you right away.
Great, thanks. Okay, so an off-topic question.
Cool.
Let's say I want to get into strategy and start selling that to clients.
Sure.
First of all, it's kind of hard mm-hmm. for me to mm-hmm. Sell things that are not sort of tangible, mm-hmm. you know, like screens, assets, stuff like that, and just the thinking part.
Yep.
That's weird for me to do. And the other question is, if I haven't done that before and I haven't seen good results from just doing that. How can I go and offer that to people and charge them lots of money for it?
Offer a guarantee, money back guarantee. If you're not happy with mm-hmm. if this thing that I gave you, if you feel like it wasn't worth it, I'll give you your money back.
Like to say, let's do just strategy, and if you're not satisfied with the strategy, I'll give you the money back?
Yeah. I mean, if that would make you feel more comfortable. Hmm. Then you do 2 or 3 of those, and if you give back the money, you know, twice, then you're right. You got something
to learn.
Yeah. Offering guarantees takes a lot of pressure off. I mean, you can get killed, so you have to be careful. You know, you don't want to work with clients who you don't trust because they could just, we're not happy with the strategy.
Yeah,
give us our money back and we're going to keep it. So, you know, don't be cavalier about it. You want to trust the people. But... yeah, I mean, that's a perfectly reasonable way to take the pressure off. Another thing you can do is do 2 or 3 beta customers. So it's talk to some people just throughout. You have to find the people. That's the tricky part. Find the clients and say, hey, I'm doing a beta testing a new service, design strategy session, or a innovation workshop or something. And maybe reach out to past clients. Maybe they've got a new project. Maybe they've got a new app they're putting together. Maybe they got some new things. Say, hey, I'm going to do it. This is an experiment for me. I am confident that you will get out of it the time that you put in, and I'm going to do it for free or like ridiculously cheap to test the idea, see if it works. And then, you know, you'd only want to do this with something that only takes you like a day or something, you know, not like a ton of time, maybe a few hours. But that would give you the confidence, like, oh yeah, I've done, I got this, I figured it out. I see the pattern here, I see how this works, I learned my lines, I know what to say, I know how to run the meeting, whatever. You just take money out of the equation and just do it. You know, it's cheaper than paying for college to do a couple of beta customers for free or cheap. So that might give you the confidence to just do that. Have you seen my altitude of involvement webinar?
No.
Yeah, you should check that out. I'll send you the link. It talks about, you know, the difference between like an architect and a carpenter and a janitor and, you know, the different levels of involvement that you can have with clients and how to move up. So you're getting closer and closer to architect and farther away from janitor.
Yeah, that's a good framing, I think.
You know, you pay an architect to design your building. You're not expecting him to change the toilet paper in the bathrooms once it's built.
Yeah, that's where I want to go.
Yeah. Cool.